2 Timothy chapter 3, Charles Dickens, in his classic work, A Tale of Two Cities, said, now somewhat famously, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom, it was the age of foolishness. If you will, as we hit the transition between 2 Timothy chapter 2 and 2 Timothy chapter 3, we almost have that same tone of stark comparison in the air. Paul has been describing for Timothy the greatness of the house. If you remember, our theme for this book has been this idea of studying, being a God-centered church in the midst of a self-centered world. And what is going to happen in the transition here at the end of chapters is he's going to turn from that great illusion, that great illustration of the house, of the church, of what it looks like, of our place within it, of what God is doing in his church, in meeting with his people, in equipping them to be and to do all that he has called them to do, and then for that church to realize that God has put it in the world. He's now going to transition, and if you will, go from the best of times to it's the worst of times. He's going to give us a glimpse of that self-centered world. And as he does, one of the things I want us to realize is that Paul is going to call our attention into the midst of looking at the world and ask us, in light of living for God, what should my focus be? Where should my attention be? Media is a powerful thing, isn't it? And right now, we are in a time where excuse me a little bit, but hysteria sells. News outlets are in a battle for market share. And so in a sense, the more they can portray the events of life in an enticing way, in a capturing way, if you will, with a sense of urgency or even desperation, the more people are going to be drawn. And so if you will, even in what is the news, there is marketing. But one of the things that the news causes us to do is to be overly drawn to the now. It would be easy to begin 2 Timothy chapter 3 and think that what Paul is doing is driving us again to put our attention on the now and the circumstances in which we find ourselves. But I want you to see that while he is going to help us have a realization, because I do think we have to have that, of what the world is like, that is not where he wants us to have our focus. You know, life is interesting, isn't it? You ask two people the same question, and it's amazing the answers that you can get. So you go to one and you say, could you help me with something? Sure. Can you tell me what is a hospital? And they go, sure, I can help you with that. That's a place where people go to die. Oh, I'm not going to the hospital. Or you walk up to somebody and say, I really need some help. Could you please tell me what is a hospital? Oh, sure, I can. That's a place where life begins. Are both true? They are. But the difference in the answer is totally a matter of the person giving the answer's perspective. Perspective matters, doesn't it? Reality of it is, there is more going on at the hospital that is about either giving or preserving life than there is about death. Oh yes, the same struggle is going on because the enemy that is being fought against is death. And so it's a constant battle and it's a constant enemy all the way from those who would come in an emergent situation into an ER and immediately they go into panic mode. They call all kinds of codes or whatever. They say things like stat. Why don't they just say now? I don't know why they, but stat. I guess it sounds better. I need that stat. Anyway. They have their own lingo. They speak their own language. They do their own stuff. But the reality of it is all about life, right? They want to preserve your life. I can tell you, though they make lots of money, their goal is for you to go home, not to stay. And so it's interesting because we could look at that and have a very different opinion. And the reality of it is we can look at life, and some of it depends upon your perspective. As we leave the imagery of the great house and transition to understanding then where this great house is built, the world in which we're in, I wonder what your perspective is of the house. It's easy, depending on what conversations you've had, what your background is, to have a skewed one way or the other perspective of the house. And you know what? I would challenge you this morning. You need to be very careful to ascertain the perspective of the people you talk to about the house. There are some who right now, just due to some of the issues we talk about and the things that we are faced with dealing with, that they really believe that Bethel Baptist Church is dying. Bethel Baptist Church, if we pursue God, will die the moment Jesus dies. That's not going to be anytime soon. This is a place of life. I spent the weekend with our deacons at a deacon's retreat. I came home very tired. Robert Croswell kept me up to 12:45. He did not. He probably would tell you the same story. We finished somewhere, I think, about 11:45 meeting as a group. And then Robert and I were roommates, and we went on and we talked some more. And you know what? I was tired, but you know what? I'm satisfied in Christ. And I'm excited about what God has done and is doing, and more excited about what God is going to do. God is doing phenomenal things at Bethel Baptist Church. It's just interesting that sometimes the conversations that so often we end in are issues of challenge, and there are things that we do need to talk about, but it's really easy to get a skewed perspective. I could not be more excited about what God is doing in the lives of our young people. And when I say young people, understand that too has a perspective to it. 40-year-olds, man, it's amazing to see what God is doing in their life. And I say that all the way from the young people that are now in our young marriage class that Michelle and I are getting to be a part of teaching. It is exciting to me to watch young couples who want the truth of God because they want the right kind of marriage. That's thrilling to me. It is thrilling to me to see what God is doing in our singles class. Right now, they're in the midst of a discussion on the conscience and what conscience should look like in being able to look at life and have that filter to make godly choices. That's phenomenal stuff. Don't you think that young people facing what we're going to see as the world need someone to help them understand the filter God has given them so they know how to live? That is awesome to me. When I look and hear and see the things that Pastor Brandon is doing with our teenagers and how they're becoming excited about the truth of God because they hear it on Sunday morning, they go and discuss it on Sunday night with real application to their life, and then they're singing about who their God is and the greatness of God. It thrills me. They're not living in a culture that wants to hear any of that. It's happening at Bethel Baptist Church. I couldn't be more thrilled about the passion of members, no matter what age they are, what demographic they are, who are embracing the idea of I want truth in community. And so that we are having an ongoing response to the idea of community Bible fellowships. I want community, but I want it to be a community that drives me to love my God through learning His truth. And so community Bible fellowships are growing. There's more people wanting to get in. There's people that are being trained to provide more groups. God is alive. Then He's at work in the house. I'll tell you, Celebration Sunday for me is going to be a line in the sand. That's what I want to be going on in my heart by way of anticipation as I come and meet with my church. Not mine because I own it, but mine because I'm a part of it. God is here and God is at work. And that's why I believe Paul starts by drawing our attention to look at the house and focusing on who am I and what's my role in the house before he takes us to look at the world. Because in a sense, I believe what he wants to be burning in our hearts is how amazing it is that God would put me in a place where I get to be a part of that house, whatever instrument I am. Maybe I'm just that shovel that they use to dig out the old coal. But you know what that shovel does? It is the one that allows for there to be the capacity for fresh wood that'll burn and light the entire house and warm everybody in it. Don't you realize then how important that shovel becomes? You see, it's a matter of perspective. I get to be in the house. And the fact that I'm in that house just happens to be that that house is in the world. So how do I view all of that? And so we come to chapter 3. He says, but understand this, that in the last days there will come times of difficulty. For people will be lovers of self, lovers of money, proud, arrogant, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, unholy, heartless, unappeasable, slanderous, without self-control, brutal, not loving good, treacherous, reckless, swollen with conceit, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having the appearance of godliness but denying its power. How in the world did Paul figure out exactly all of the candidates that were going to run in our presidential election? It's unbelievable to me. He just covered the entire gamut. And the news would have us focused on that all the time. But I want you to see that that's not what Paul is trying to leave on the heart of this young pastor who is called to lead a church in that kind of setting in Ephesus. Paul's finished talking about Timothy's commission to fulfill, and now he's going to lay out for him, in a sense, the conflict to face. And what Paul will do in this after this charge is call Timothy. Now, here's where you have to live, and you have to live there with the realization that there is opposition. And he describes that opposition, as we'll see today in verses 1 through 4, in a general sense. And then next time we come back, we'll look at a description of that society in light of religion and religious leaders. And I believe that's what he does. And so as we come then, I want us to see the way things are at the end of times. And in light of that, I want us to stop and ask ourselves, how should I be living in light of that truth? With this understanding that we must live godly lives in light of the end of times. We must live godly lives in light of the end of times. And so what you'll see is he begins with a call to attention. This little expression, but understand, is actually now let me have your attention for a minute. I was engaged in doing youth evangelism for a while and doing youth events. I found techniques that would help me get kids' attention because I wanted them to enjoy things, but then there were times you need to get their attention back. And one of the things I discovered was if they were talking, when I got to 5, I took points away. They became self-policing. So when I wanted their attention, I would go, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. If I got to 1, somebody was talking, their team lost points. It was not very long before I'd say, 5, and they started whacking each other. Hey, poof, hey, quit, stop, shoot, huh, whoa. They became self-pleasing. I didn't have to tell anybody to be quiet. They got called to attention, if you will. That's what this phrase now is going to do here for us. It's a call to attention. There's something I need you to wake up and listen to. There's something that you have to get your brain engaged about. What is that? It'd be easy to read right through this passage and say, you know, what that is the condition of the world around me. But I want you to see that there's something actually that even the condition of the world around me ought to be driving me to think about. What is that thing? It is actually for us just something we can read in a hurry and brush by as though it's just a couple of words on the page, and we read end of times that way. But theologically, it is the grand truth that is at the heart of this passage of Scripture, that in the last days, Well, we ought to be asking a couple of questions. When are the last days? That's probably the primary question that comes to our mind. And the thought being, if I knew they were the last days, then I would feel more of a sense of urgency. Well, I will tell you, there's probably a more important question theologically than just when are the last days? And it is this question, what are the last days? Is that talking about a thing? And so what I want you to see is that there is the need for awareness, the need for careful awareness. Paul says to Timothy to be keenly aware of what lies ahead. No, ginoske is a present imperative stressing the importance of this exhortation. You must keep on knowing. You should live in a way that you are going to be continuing to understand. Life must become about you becoming more and more and more aware of what it means to be in the last days. I want you to see here that he does not call him to understand the condition of the world. He's going to use the condition of the world as an impetus for why I should live considering the last days. Can I tell you that the greatest struggle that men have with living with the perspective of the eternal is that it is so easy for us to live with a perspective of the temporal. And when we do, you can be sure of this, in one way or another, we will live with adjusted priorities. Remember, what do you believe? In light of what you believe, what are your values? In light of your values, what are the principles that lead you to the living by priorities? And one of the things we have to understand and believe is, what is God talking about the last days? When are they? What are they? What's the importance of that? Why is that significant? And in light of that, then say, here's then the things that I value. And in light of the things that I value, then I say, I am going to live this way because of what I value based upon what I believe. So what does it mean to you when I say, Jesus is coming again? To the vast majority of you sitting here today, you would say, yeah, I know that. I've known that for a long time. But if I said to you, Jesus is coming today, that has a different impact, doesn't it? And so the thought being, the world is going to end someday. I know that. But you imagine the urgency if I said the world is going to end today. There's an awful lot of us whose faith would look just like Chicken Little's. There's a need for careful awareness because many believers have a tendency to think about what God is doing in the unfolding of his story in a remote or distant way. We all know that someday we're going to die. How much does that actually impact the way you live? The early church greeted one another with this phrase. It wasn't howdy, how y'all doing, what's up. It wasn't any of those things. It was Maranatha. The Lord is coming. That's how they greeted one another. In other words, as they came together, they lived in the society in which they were in with the constant awareness that Jesus is coming. See, the reality of it is approximately one-third of the Bible is prophetic in nature. Why is that? Why do you think God would have laid out such a large portion of his revelation in such a way that it is causing us to look toward future, even eternal events? The first sermon of the church age came forth dripping with prophetic references, resulting in new life for about 3,000 souls in Acts 2. Christ's last words to the church age are prophetic. Surely I am coming quickly, Revelation 22:20. And if our generation of Christians were to emphasize a future focus the same way the first generation of believers did, then we too would begin, I believe, to have a similar impact on a world that is stuck in the now. Alexander McLaren said this: the primitive church thought more about the second coming of Jesus Christ than about death or heaven. They were not looking for a cleft in the ground called the grave, but for a cleavage in the sky called glory. They were not looking for the undertaker, but the upper taker. They felt that man's chief end was to get right with God or be left behind when Christ returned. Oh, may we be gripped with the same holy expectation as we live for God. Because you see, it's all too easy for us to get caught up in the hysteria of the way things are. I do not believe that believers will be properly motivated to live godly lives because they make the condition of the world around them their primary focus and live saying, don't do that, and don't do that, and don't do that, and don't do that. I believe that the condition of things is merely a measuring stick by which we should determine the nearness of that which we should focus on. The end of times. Listen to what Peter said in 2 Peter 3. Waiting for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be set on fire and dissolved, and the heavenly bodies will melt as they burn. But according to his promise, we are waiting for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. Therefore, beloved, since you are waiting for these, be diligent to be found by him without spot or blemish and at peace. What should motivate me to live a godly life? Not because I'm going to be different than the disaster of the world around me, but because I am looking for the master of the house to come back. Hebrews 12, therefore, since we're surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Looking at the world and how bad it is, go out and survey the race course and make sure you know where every pothole is, because you don't want to twist your ankle and that would ruin your race. No, he says, looking to Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him. And it's because of that that he challenges us with this thought, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted in your struggle against sin. You have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. You see, the reality is there's a need for awareness. And Paul is going to describe the conditions around us in a sense to say, you know what, as you see these things, it ought to make you aware that Jesus is just about to win. Now, I say that speaking in human terms. It's never been in question. But it's easy to look at the circumstances of life and feel that more and more and more the garment of what I call civility is unraveling and things are going into chaos and, oh my word, what are we going to do? And God, have you watched this lately? And you know what we want to do? We want to give God the numbers. 210, God, that's Fox News. You'll learn a lot there, God. You might want to be aware, God, of what's happening right now. God, do you even know who the Republican candidates are? You see, this penchant to focus on the present almost distorts our view of reality. what he is saying is you need to go back and look at the universal picture with the eternal lens and realize who God is, for God is the one who said to you, I know exactly what I will be doing when I come back. Not one of it has slipped out from under my focus. As we do that, one of the things he calls us to is not just the need of awareness, but to realize then the nearness of the end. You ever noticed that no matter how godless a man is, they tend to have a fascination with the end of the world? You ever noticed that? Man has created in their vivid imagination an ending for the world in every way you can possibly imagine. You don't want to go to the bottom of the sea. Why? Because if you happen to make a crack there, it's all over. The whole world ends. And you better be careful about going too far into outer space. Why? Because you might, whatever that is up there that we don't know, you might poke a hole in it. And if you do, the whole thing goes down like a balloon. I mean, it's going to bust up from the inside. It's going to get smashed from the outside. I mean, men have created ways that the world ends with everything from Martians to meteors. This phrase, the last days, properly refers to those days just prior to Christ's return. There are some that because of that say, see, you can't even believe Paul. He's 2,000 years old. And he thought they were happening next week. So they discount Paul because of what he said in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 11. It's taken 2,000 years, and so he must have missed it. The reality of it is, Peter said this, don't forget this one thing. That one day is with the Lord as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is one day. You see, we are the ones who have problems with time, not God. He made it. The finite periods of time we call days are meaningless measurements to the one who is the author of eternity, who is both beginning and end simultaneously. How ludicrous, how arrogant a mortal man whose life is a vapor to subject the infinite eternal God to a finite temporal timeline. God, do you know what time it is? Yeah, I made it. No one else gets to answer that way. You see, just because God does not set his watch according to ours, it doesn't mean that he is late for what we think is our appointment. You ever notice that? More and more? For example, you go to the dentist and he gives you an appointment time. Do you know that's one-sided? It's for you. It's not for him. He comes when he's ready, but you have to be there at the appointment time. The reality of it is, we are ones who think we're establishing the appointments whenever we're the ones setting the times. Can I tell you that you'll find as you live life, God's not going to keep your appointments. But he does have his own. And the reality of it is, according to Peter, every second that he prolongs his coming is a second of grace, for its purpose is that in his sovereignty, none would perish and all would come to repentance. So in a sense, one of the things we need to do then is get a picture of God's timeline. For you see, until Christ, time was heading clearly and manageably and in a way that was measurable toward a cliff. All of it marching towards, if you will, this cliff that ultimately all things would fall off of at his second coming. And so you look, if you will, prophetically through the whole of the Old Testament, and don't run too far with my analogy. This is simplified. But if you look at it, you look back, you will find that systematically all things are marching in a very clear direction and ultimately going to end at a very clear point. And so it seems like all the time everything is affirmation of that direction and that destination. From the time that Christ came, there was a mystery that Paul reveals, that God reveals to Paul. And in a sense, we got to the edge of the cliff and took a right-hand turn known as the church age. And now throughout the church age, God has been carrying out exactly the plan that he has had in place. And he is doing all of that in this age until he is done. And one of the things that we have to tell ourselves is, oh, it was much further to the cliff than I thought. No, it wasn't. We are running parallel to it. And when God is done, Jesus comes, and we're still right at the cliff. And the second coming happens. And so when I live with the idea of the imminent return of Christ, what I realize is that God brought time all the way to the culmination of events. And there at the edge of the precipice is the church age. And if I come back to this timeline where there was this valley that they could not see, the reality of it is they saw this is the very next thing. And they were right, because we are now abiding on the edge of the cliff. The cliff where time encounters Jesus again. So the reality of it is that if we're going to realize the nearness of the time, we must realize, you know what? It could be another 1,000 years. I am not God. Israel could be in and out of the land 6 more times before Jesus decides he's coming again. But I look at it and say, man, everything is there so that Jesus could come again. How should I live? And I should live that way, realizing I am living at the edge of the cliff of prophetic times. Eschatology's end is right here, and I live in light of that, because God at any moment can make the left-hand turn. That's up to him. When Paul says these are the last days, he literally is right. These are the days in which men will live until the last. There isn't going to be another phase. There isn't going to be another dispensation. This is it. These days, whatever they are and however long they last, these are these last days. And when they end, what is next is the day of the Lord. That day, which I believe clearly defined by Paul in his theology, begins with the rapture, Jesus coming in the air, not to the earth, calling out the church, which is the ending of what I see theologically to be spirit baptism, that which inaugurated the church. It is the non-experiential, judicial act of God whereby New Testament believers are placed into the body of Christ. And that inaugurated the church. And in order for there to be next, that age must end. And it will end when the Spirit's role of spirit baptism is taken away. And when that happens, he who now restrains will restrain no more. And what happens is that day of tribulation, 7 years of the unveiling of who God is. That's what the tribulation is. And it's a return to dealing with Israel. And so they will see Jesus as the Messiah. And they missed that the first time. And at the end of those 7 years, the Lord will return in his second coming. He'll set up a kingdom that'll be for 1,000 years, and his arch enemy, as he has declared himself to be, will be imprisoned for those 1,000 years. And at the end of those 1,000 years, he'll be released and again lead a great rebellion of men. And there will be no question, as Jesus metes out the just wrath upon those rebels, as to who he is. And it will end in the eternal day. My friends, Paul's calling for us to understand the times is that I live, I will always live, I will live until Jesus says now at the edge of the precipice of eschatology. Do you know how exciting that is? That's what Paul is saying to Timothy and to the church in this world, that's how they must live. In other words, as I come out of this great house, the master is coming. And he could come today. He could come at any time. You need to live with that conscious awareness. This is not unraveling. This is actually flowing towards his designated end. And he is my God. He is the one who chose me. He is the one that positioned me through justification. He is the one who is transforming me through sanctification. And I cannot wait until he comes. And I greet him in glorification. And I'll be changed to be like he is. That's why I should live the way I live. And it's in light of that, then, that he brings us to this understanding of the nature of the time. Why? Because this is what it's going to be like. This is what it's going to look like. And as difficult as things were for Timothy, now looking at where we are 2,000 years later, they were destined to only become worse. Paul describes these coming days as perilous days. The Greek word he uses is used only one other time in the New Testament. And there it describes two demon-possessed men who were exceedingly fierce. Broke chains. No one could constrain them. They were overwhelmed and overpowered, and thus they became overwhelming and overpowering. They were completely controlled with that which is evil. That was used to describe those two demon-possessed men. It's the same word he uses to describe the days that are coming. Days preceding the return of Christ will be exceedingly fierce, and worldwide conditions will be hideous to behold. Go read Matthew 24. I don't know about you, but have you taken a look around lately? I don't mean just within our country. Because by comparison, we look at where we were and where we think we are today, and we think, man, it's gotten bad. Step outside your bubble for a minute. I've gotten to see the conditions in Haiti. I've been to Eastern Europe and experienced the condition and have been arrested for just having a Bible in Pregnestrovia. I've seen the filth and despair. I've been to Central America and experienced the sickness and deprivation that pervaded Honduras and Guatemala. I've been to rural Mexico and seen the hurt and the harshness. I've been again to Kenya and to Zambia. I've seen what disease is doing in Africa. Can I tell you, these are perilous times. But the question that must bring to our hearts is, what does that mean? How should I live? Where should I be looking? What should my focus be? Because as I see those events, I ought to hear somewhere in the back of my mind that this world is on a clock and it is ticking every day toward the end. As the time flitters away, the days become more and more perilous and more chaotic. Can you hear them ticking away? Are you looking and listening? Are you ready for the end? Paul writes to Timothy and he calls him and us to attention. And if you will, he says, look around you. You better wake up. And that doesn't mean, well, you know what? I better watch more news. Remember where he's come from. What does it look like to wake up and get to attention? It means I must function in the house the way God designed me to function. Why? Because the master's coming. And that's the right place to be. Jesus asked, will I find you looking? If you will, the right motivation for godly living from this passage of Scripture is not to get more discouraged over the condition of the world. It is to become more excited about the condition of the house. And thus, he gives for us the condition of men. And he gives it in graphic detail, not so that we can have a better understanding of men, but so that in light of understanding men, we will understand what it means to be ready when Jesus comes. He gives us this understanding so that we won't live in shock and awe. He gives it to us with a sense that we would understand so that we're not going to live in absolute terror, that we're not going to retreat and in ineptitude. He says, this is how it's going to be. Would the coach who told his team this Friday night, now when we go out there, what I want you to know is this team stinks. I mean, they're just really no good. Can't throw the ball, can't run the ball, spend most of their time on defense waving to the fans. all the while knowing that this will be the best team that they've seen all season. But you know what? I don't want the boys to be overwhelmed. I'll just make them believe that they really stink. And they'll go out there and they'll think this is going to be an easy game, and they'll just run over. Chances are he's looking for a coaching job next year. There's a reason that we have a sense of reality. And the reason is not so we get overwhelmed by what the reality is. It is so that we live in preparation. And so I gave to you in your bulletin there a detailed list. As Paul gave it to us, and I gave you there intentionally the Greek words that are connected to them. Because as we see those things, we ought to say to ourselves, huh, wow, that's terrible. Jesus is coming. That's disgusting. Jesus is coming. That's shocking. Jesus is coming. But before he gets to that detailed list, one of the things that he does is give us two general principles, and I want to deal with those as I close. He says, first of all, they'll be lovers of self. Lovers of self. This word is a contemplated sparing of self and providing things easy and pleasant for self. In other words, it is the slogan, it is all about me. Do you realize that as believers, when we live in the world with the slogan, it's all about me, when I treat others with the mindset, it's all about me, when I parent with the mantra, it's all about me, when I treat my spouse as though it's all about me, that I actually reflect in my character the character of the condition of men when God says, I've had enough. It's one of the general characteristics of the condition of men at the end of times. They are lovers of self. You see, in the garden when man fell, he went from having a God-interested nature to having a self-interested nature. Therefore, when God comes to us and meets us in the transaction of redemption, his purpose is to change us from having a self-interested nature back to having a God-interested nature. And I live like fallenness when I live with the self-interested nature. Do you know that is the great battle that we face in the house, trying to put the house together? It's that waging, raging war of self and God. It's God's house, but we're in it together. So who gets their way? Who gets to do their thing? Who gets to be first? Somebody's got to be first. I really believe that there's some believers that that's their mantra. It's, well, somebody's got to be first. It might as well be me. Do you know that Jesus says just the opposite? Somebody has to be first. Make sure you're last. That's what he says. Even the Son of Man came not to be ministered under, but to minister and make himself a servant to all. The first shall be last, the last shall be first. He that would be greatest among you, let him be servant of all. If someone has to be first, make sure you're last. We struggle with that. You know what'll happen if I do that? I'll become a doormat. And the problem is, because you see, the question we should ask is, if that's what actually happens, whose doormat am I? You're God's. The second characteristic that marks them then is that they are lovers of money, and that is what draws them to this penchant with the now. They're lovers of money. And when a man loves solely for his own welfare, then the acquisition of wealth becomes an insatiable appetite. It causes men to forget and ultimately forsake God and all integrity. He will find a way to transform decency into a lust for the dollar. What are you living for? What are the great priorities of your life? Because a man who becomes consumed with consumerism And he now has this driving desire for measurable achievement only in this life. His life will end up marked by the characters of those at the end of times when Jesus says, I've had enough.